Welcome to International Edition, where we take a closer look at stories of the day, social media, and entertainment. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to the confirmed death sentence against Egypt's Morsi. Would Houthis give up military gains for a truce in Yemen? Robot insurance might not be needed in the future. And some of the musical artists hitting the road.
Being out on tour is how you pay the bills. And venues are popping worldwide right now with numerous artists on the road making money.
Coming up right here on The Voice of America. The United States says it's deeply troubled by what White House spokesman Josh Earnest calls the politically motivated sentence of death confirmed Tuesday by an Egyptian court against former President Mohamed Morsi and dozens of others. That's stemming from a mass jailbreak and attacks on police during the 2011 uprising.
The United States has repeatedly raised concerns about the detention and sentencing of a variety of political figures in Egypt, and we are concerned that the proceedings have been conducted in a way that is not only contrary to universal values, but also damaging to the stability that all Egyptians deserve. In particular, we condemn the practice of mass trials and sentences which are conducted in a manner that is inconsistent with Egypt's international obligations and are frequently used against members of the opposition and nonviolent activists, including leaders in civil society and even some independent journalists. This practice is unjust and undermines confidence in the rule of law in Egypt. And again, this is a message that we've delivered publicly, but it's also one that's been communicated directly to Egypt.
The court Tuesday also imposed a life sentence on the former Egyptian leader in a separate case involving conspiring with foreign groups, including the Palestinian militant group Hamas. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon also denounced the court's actions, warning such verdicts handed down after mass trials may well have a negative impact on the prospects for long-term stability in Egypt. He urged Egyptian authorities to ensure the defendants can benefit from due process and guarantees of a fair trial. My colleague Victor Beatty has been following this story, and he joins me now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Well, thank you, Susan.
What have you found out?
Well, Middle East analyst Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco told me that he doubts Morsi will actually be put to death.
The Egyptian regime would really be overreaching if they actually went ahead with these executions. As unpopular as the Muslim Brotherhood and President Morsi was among Egyptians and elsewhere, these are clearly excessive sentences, quite dubious in terms of their legality, and it would only isolate Egypt in world public opinion, not to mention encourage the more radical elements of the Islamist opposition. At the same time, there have been a number of cases where the Egyptian regime has gone beyond expectations to engage in acts of serious repression. So we can't underestimate the possibility that they might go ahead with the executions anyway.
At the same time, former President Hosni Mubarak's charges are slowly dropping away. Do you see any irony or linkage between these two cases?
The two cases are very much linked. In many ways, we are seeing the restoration of military rule we saw during Mubarak's 30 years in power. Let's remember that Hosni Mubarak was the head of the Egyptian Air Force. He was a career military officer himself prior to being named Sadat's vice president and soon coming to power following Sadat's assassination. Sadat himself, like Nasser, were high-ranking officers in the Egyptian military as well. So we're seeing essentially a return to military rule, and in all three of these governments, the Muslim Brotherhood was a target of persecution.
The Muslim Brotherhood on Tuesday described the rulings handed down as null and void, called for a popular uprising on Friday. What's the likelihood of violence returning to the streets of Egypt?
If they're protest, even if they are nonviolent, there's little question that the regime will respond violently. They seem to believe that with the backing of the United States and with at least some degree of popular support, they can get away with pretty serious human rights abuses. Of course, their oppression has gone well beyond just the Islamic opposition, but the democratic, secular, and liberal opposition as well. Many of the leaders of the popular uprising against Mubarak are now in jail themselves, even though they also joined the protest against Morsi when he was president. So what we're seeing, basically, is a return to an authoritarian rule that, in certain ways, is even more oppressive than it was under the Mubarak era.
And Stephen Zuna says he doesn't expect these sentences to disrupt U.S.-Egyptian relations. Ties have been strained, of course, since Morsi's ouster back in July of 2013. Washington temporarily froze military assistance to Cairo worth more than $1 billion, but most of that aid was restored last year.
Well, thank you very much, Victor.
Thank you, Susan.
Interest in Mohamed Morsi's case has been pretty high on Twitter in the past 2 days. Michael Lippin is here to tell us more about that. Michael?
Hi, Susan. That's right. The Topsy Analytics website shows that the ousted president's English family name, Morsi, has been mentioned almost 10,000 times on Twitter in the past day, and another 14,000 times the day before, easily the highest figures for the past month. I've also been looking at what people have been saying about Morsi on Twitter so far today, and I came across a post by a member of the U.S.-based rights group Human Rights Watch. Now, Nadim Houri tweeted a link to HRW's statement about the latest Egyptian court ruling, which it criticized as being compromised by what it described as process violations that appear to have been politically motivated. I've also seen reactions to the ruling from governments in the region. Two nations that have long supported the Muslim Brotherhood politically, Turkey and Qatar, were critical of the Egyptian move, as you might expect. The Ahram online news site tweeted this headline: Turkey's President Erdogan condemns Morsi's confirmed death sentence. And I also saw Arab media columnist Sultan Al-Qassemi tweet a link to a report by Lebanon's Daily Star newspaper. It ran a French news agency article saying the Qatari government is calling for Morsi to be released. Susan?
Thanks, Michael. Our listeners are tuned to VOA.
Several studies conducted with data gathered by NASA's Curiosity rover suggested that Mars may have once been warm and wet, with an abundance of water flowing over its surface. But now, scientists at Harvard University say that after running several possible scenarios on a computer model, they've found evidence that quite the opposite is true. They say that early in its history, the red planet may have actually been quite cold, with an average global temperature of minus 48 degrees Celsius. Any Martian water that existed then would have been in the form of ice. A lack of sunshine may have been a factor. The red planet today gets only about 43% as much of the sun's energy as Earth does. And eons ago, a young sun may have delivered even less, only about 25% of what it does today. The researchers also say that signs of water damage and erosion near Mars' equator can be explained by an extreme tilt the planet once had in its axis. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for a truce among warring parties in Yemen during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which starts this week. The appeal was made as national reconciliation talks began in Geneva. Ban urged the warring factions to implement what he called local ceasefires in different parts of the nation, leading later to a national ceasefire. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke about the challenges facing the Geneva talks with Professor Charles Schmitz, a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Mohamed joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Mohamed.
Thank you.
Hey, with the Houthis relentlessly fighting and a Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen that apparently did not tip the balance in favor of the internationally recognized government, what could peace talks produce?
According to Professor Schmitz, the gap between the warring factions is too wide to have any high hopes for the Geneva talks.
The best that it could produce is opening channels for talks and perhaps some lowering the level of conflict to allow more humanitarian relief, because the one of the factors that's pushing politically all sides of this conflict is that there is a major humanitarian crisis brewing inside of Yemen. I mean, the country has been cut off from food and fuel for 2 months now, and the situation is getting quite desperate, and that's becoming a factor in the negotiation. So I think what we might see out of this is a truce that allows humanitarian aid in at some level.
Yemen's acting foreign minister, Riyad Hassin, said that for his government to accept a humanitarian truce, the Houthis should begin to pull out of major cities and provinces. Would Houthis give away their military gains for a humanitarian truce?
Actually, Sue, we all know that the UN Security Council Resolution 2216 originally called on them to withdraw and give up the weapons they seized from the Yemeni army. However, they refused. Professor Schmitz argues that Yemen needs a political settlement that allows rebuilding a national army, ratifying a constitution, and holding legitimate elections, but he said it's too far on the horizon.
They're not very feasible. I would say that it's a long time before that's going to happen. I wouldn't expect that to happen for another 2 years. The major challenges at this point, I think, are the Saudi and their backers. So it would be, Hadi and his allies, who they need to compromise. They need to recognize that the Houthi will be an important part of the future of Yemen. They acknowledge that the Houthi will be a part of Yemen's political future, but they want them to surrender completely first, which they're not going to do. And I think the Saudis and the Yemeni that are backed by the Saudis are going to have to back down on that. A lot of the resistance to the Houthi is independent of Hadi and his government in Saudi Arabia, and their interests don't necessarily, particularly in the south, align with Hadi. And so what I suspect is that there's going to be a Houthi, and then sort of more domestic, the resistance forces are going to begin to work something out on their own, and that will probably form the basis of a political settlement.
He said the situation is very complicated, and the only urgent challenge right now is the humanitarian crisis that affects almost 80% of the Yemeni population.
Well, thank you very much, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Coming up on International Edition, robots on the march, and we hear from some of the artists who've been on the road. There is an old Saturday night comedy sketch about how old people in the future should buy robot insurance. They warn that the robots are strong and can get mean and may attack their owners. Well, the thought of needing robot insurance is pretty funny, but not so fast. Some people are concerned about the effects of the robot era. Editor Gideon Rose, in the introduction to the next issue of Foreign Affairs, considers what the future will bring, and he joins us on the line. Hello, Mr. Rose.
Good to be here.
Thank you, thank you. What do we have to worry about? Do we all need robot insurance?
Well, it's not a question of worry. The technology has always changed work and life. And it seems pretty clear that we're going through another phase, another shift of that with automation and robotics and artificial intelligence. And so the real question is, what benefits is that shift going to bring, and what are the downsides that it's going to bring, and how do we, as a society, as individuals, deal with it?
Well, I guess the benefits we can all guess, more efficient, less work, but less work also means less jobs. What are the bad sides?
Well, this is an interesting question. So there's certainly less work for some people. But the question that's really up in the air is whether there will be less work total. Let's take driverless cars. Obviously, people who currently drive cars for a living are going to be out of a job. And if there are fewer accidents, then there are going to be fewer mechanics needed. So that's going to be good for people who want to get places and good for people who want to be safe, but bad for people who drive cars and bad for people who fix cars. On the other hand, the really interesting question we don't know about is, will the advances and efficiencies that come from driverless cars end up generating so much more demand and so much more interesting jobs that the overall economy will benefit and the overall amount of jobs will increase for humans, even if some individual people and industries lose out?
Well, being a human myself, I have to think that I have some qualities that a machine doesn't have. What do humans have that robots don't?
We have some great pieces in the package on this. One of the things that humans have is they have the ability to communicate very easily. They have the ability to size up new situations. They have the ability to do pattern recognition. They can learn. And there are a lot of things that humans are better at than machines, at least for now. They're also in charge of the overall economy and the political system. So if humans band together, they can prevent themselves from being made obsolete. Right now, the Democratic Party is trying to block a free trade deal because its unionized laborers don't want to lose jobs, and they can basically sort of make everything grind to a halt. So you could imagine a situation in which there are political blockages to moving into this new robotic future, as well as economic ones.
It seems like the technology is really moving along fast.
It definitely does seem like things are shooting forward quickly, and in many respects they are. But what we tend to take for granted is how quickly things shot forward in the past. One of my favorite pieces in the issue is by Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, who's kind of a curmudgeonly skeptic of all this. And his point is that although there are indeed changes that are occurring now, these changes pale in comparison to what used to happen. And so the overall picture, truly, in historical perspective, is of things being relatively modestly changing. So, for example, he says, driverless cars, that's cool, certainly. But you know what's really cool? Cars themselves. So the shift going from no cars to cars is a hell of a lot bigger than the shift from going from our driving cars to a car that drives itself.
Well, just to remind our listeners, the article will be in the next edition of Foreign Affairs. That's the July issue, right?
Yep, July, August, Foreign Affairs on newsstands pretty soon, and it's a great issue, lots of great stuff in it.
Well, it caught my eye. Thank you so much for your time and insight.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Trending on the web, it's action, reaction.
Some very talented celebrities are also apparently very smart. Mindy Kaling, who starred in the American TV show The Office, graduated from Dartmouth College. She jokes she went to Ivy League to, quote, pursue her love of white people and North Face parkas. Another comedian with brains, Rashida Jones. She graduated from Harvard in 1997, and not only did she get her degree in acting, she wrote scores for the infamous Hasty Pudding Club. Among Harvard's other prestigious graduates are Oscar winner Natalie Portman and late-night TV funny man Conan O'Brien.
Good morning and congratulations to the Dartmouth class of 2011.
Conan edited the Harvard Lampoon.
I must point out that behind me sits a highly admired president of the United States and decorated war hero, while I, a cable television talk show host, has been chosen to stand here and impart wisdom.
For VOA's Action Reaction, I'm Lisa Vora.
Being on the road can be a real strain on a musician, but maybe it's a necessary evil. Steve Norman has this look at some of the artists that have been out there.
Whether it's superstar Ariana Grande or an older rocker like former Beatle Ringo Starr, or the country western hit band Lady Antebellum, being out on tour is how you pay the bills. And venues are popping worldwide right now with numerous artists on the road making money. There was a time when musical artists made their money from album sales and they toured largely to promote those albums. Well, that's all shifted since the advent of music downloads, which provide smaller amounts of income for the artist. Now it's the tour that counts, like Grande's current sold-out performances all over the world. At 21, Ariana Grande, who got her start on Broadway and TV's Nickelodeon, is just about as hot as a hit artist can be. Remember the Beatles drummer Ringo Starr?
What's my name? Ringo! What's my name?
Just in case anybody forgot.
Well, at 74, Ringo's out on the road singing new songs and, of course, some old favorites like It Don't Come Easy. Like other legends of music, Ringo Starr stays ever so busy out on the road performing before packed houses.
You don't have to shout or leave about. You can even play them easy. Open up your heart and come together.
In the world of country western music, no band has Lady Antebellum beat.
This world keeps spinning faster. Into a new disaster, so far on to you, higher unto you, baby. When it all starts coming undone, baby, you're the only one I run to. I run to you.
Lady Antebellum got started in the capital of country music, Nashville, in 2006. And like Ariana Grande and Ringo Starr, they have tons of music industry awards on top of an already very excited bunch of fans who follow them out on the road on tour.
From hate, I run from prejudice, I run from pessimists, but I run too late. I run my life, or is it running me, run from my past? I run too fast, or too slow it seems. When lies become the truth, that's when I run to
like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll on down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
5 years ago, Burma, newly emerging from 5 decades of military rule, started moving toward an increasingly democratic rule. According to senior U.S. government officials, Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Tom Malinowski, Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Scott Marcial, and Assistant Administrator for USAID Jonathan Stivers, in testimony before the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee on June 11th, Burma is undergoing an evolution, not a revolution, with each step carefully negotiated between representatives of its old and new orders. Burma is still dealing with the multiple legacies of its former dictatorship, one of the world's longest-running armed conflicts, a constitution that grants the military extraordinary powers, and ethnic and religious tensions that cannot be addressed in a closed society and that irresponsible political forces can exploit in a society that is opening. This is an important year for Burma, which will hold a national election in November. A successful transition to democracy will depend on the government's continued dialogue with civil society, ethnic groups, and the political opposition to build trust and foster national reconciliation. Constitutional amendments to reduce the military's role in the civilian government and improve the people's ability to elect leaders of their choice, and additional measures to protect the rights of members of ethnic and religious minorities. The country is ethnically diverse, with 135 officially recognized ethnic nationalities and a history of ethnic conflict. The humanitarian situation in Rakhine State remains grim, and we continue to underscore with the Burmese government the importance of addressing the root causes driving Rohingya migrants to leave their country. The Burmese government has begun to take steps to resolve some of the long-standing problems, including engaging in negotiations with ethnic armed groups in the country. In his testimony before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that it is critical that the parties engage in an inclusive, transparent, and meaningful political dialogue that addresses long-standing differences. The United States, in coordination with other members of the international community, will continue to support the peace process going forward. This is an opportunity for Burma to set an example of peaceful transition to democracy for other countries in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.